Well, I reckon about half of the people here were politically really plugged in and conscious a decade ago. So I'm going to let you in on something that happened then, which was there were a few bumps in the global economy and its progression to a world of plenty for all. The global financial crisis saw massive levels of unemployment across the planet. It saw people kicked out of their homes. It saw huge attacks on wages, both the paid wage and also the social wage in the form of welfare payments, unemployment benefits, and so on. Between 2008 and 2012, there were 14 million completed foreclosures on homes in the United States. And in that last year of 2012, another 1.4 million homes were in some stage of foreclosure. And other people, in other words, people were being kicked out of the homes that they owned with the banks because the banks had decided that they didn't want partners anymore. There was incredible unevenness in the experience of the economic crisis, and I guess two poles are on the one hand Australia, which got through the crisis pretty well. Australian growth continued to a significant extent due to the brilliant policies of the Australian Labor government, who had the foresight to plant large amounts of coal and iron ore under the subsoil in Australia, which could subsequently be exported to China. On the other hand, we have Greece, where the government was essentially bankrupt, where a left social democratic government capitulated to the troika of the IMF, the World Bank and the European Central Bank, and instituted a whole series of cuts. Wages in Greece have gone down by about 20%. There have been incredible declines in social security payments, especially of pensions. Since then, there has been a slow and partial recovery. Ruling classes across the world have been attempting to rip back concessions that they have made over previous decades to workers in terms of wages and conditions and provision by governments. Let alone they at level of hostility to any improvement in the conditions of working class life. Now, I said that Australia was largely spared the global financial crisis, but my one stunning visual aid, which will be looming over us until the machine times out during this session, is of productivity and real wages in Australia back to 2002. And for those up the back, you might be able to see the bottom scale. And it's 2004 to 2016. And what we can see there is that Australian real wages have trended upwards between 2003, really, and 2013, with a bit of a dip during the global financial crisis. But since 2013, they've essentially been stagnant. Now, the Australian economy is not in a recession. The Australian economy is still growing tolerably well, not absolutely powering along, but growing reasonably well, and yet real wages are stagnant. On the other hand, what workers are producing, that's still going up. In other words, profits are still in pretty reasonable shape. So can you imagine what's going to happen when the demand for labour... Sorry, I'll be neutral. If the demand for labour should ever fall, what's going to happen to real wages in Australia? So this is the background. A very, very deep global economic crisis. These things happen. They have happened in all of our lifetimes, whether we were aware of their significance at the time or not. And the question is, why do they happen? And will it happen again? And something that I am not going to give you an answer to, because if I could give you an answer to this, I'd be an extremely rich person. When will it happen again, if it's going to happen? Now, I think that the Marxist explanation of this is actually not so complex, which is why I insisted that the title of this talk be changed. It is not a complex theory. It's one that takes a little bit of background, a bit of explanation, but it's not so difficult to understand, and it's that theory that I'm mainly going to concentrate on today, and some of its rivals, both amongst Marxists and also amongst other people, other economists who have come to grips or have attempted to come to grips with the issue of economic cycles and economic crisis. I'll make my position clear to start with. Well, my position is probably pretty clear from my brief curriculum vitae already presented to you, and that is the theory of crisis, and beyond the theory of economic crisis, the theory of economic breakdown of capitalism is crucial for Marxism, and it's not crucial for Marxism in some abstract philosophical sense. It's actually crucial for revolutionary politics. And this argument goes back to the Communist Manifesto, which Karl and Freddie knocked together in late 1847 and early 1848. They said that the bourgeoisie is unfit to rule because it is incompetent to assure an existence to its slaves within their slavery, because it cannot help letting them sink into such a state that it has to feed them instead of being fed by them. Society can no longer live under this bourgeoisie. In other words, its existence is no longer compatible with society. And what Marx is saying here is pretty straightforward. Capitalism cannot sustain the living standards of those who produce profits, of those who make the economy go round, of its slaves. In other words, its wage slaves, the proletariat, the working class. That was premature. This conclusion was repeated on the basis of a much deeper analysis once Marx had actually worked out in some detail his own labour theory of value, which I'm assuming that most of you have some basic understanding of, in Capital. So there Marx wrote in the first volume, which was actually published during his lifetime, the monopoly of capital becomes a fetter upon the mode of production which has flourished alongside and under it. The centralisation of the means of production and the socialisation of labour reach a point at which they become incompatible with their capitalist integument, their binding. This integument is burst asunder. The knell of capitalist private property sounds, and we can hear it echoing today. This contrasts with the position of mainstream economists, and the most orthodox mainstream economists, the ones who establish the tone in university economics departments, which probably be better labelled, more accurately labelled, departments of capitalist theology, because what they do is justify the way the world is. Mainstream economics, which is technically neoclassical economic theory, which is neoliberal ideology, attributes crises to extra economic factors. One of the founders of neoclassical economics, of marginalist economics, a guy called Jevons, who actually had an association with this very city in the middle of the 19th century, worked at the New South Wales Mint. I don't know if his inspirations came from there. Possibly he would have got a lot of sun when he was in Australia from Britain. And that's important because the exogenous factor, the outside factor that Stanley Jevons attributed to economic cycles to was, that's obvious, isn't it, sunspots. That had an effect through agriculture and then from agriculture to other sections of the economy. That particular argument hasn't been made quite so much recently, but it's other economic, extra-economic factors that mainstream economists of the neoclassical kind attribute crises to. In particular, to mistaken government policy, and in particular government policies that interfere too much or possibly at all with markets, and also trade unions, which are obviously an impediment to the effective operation of the market because they attempt to engage in monopoly behaviour with respect to the supply of what mainstream economists call labour, but which we know is not labour. It's the ability to work. It's labour power that they attempt, sadly, rather ineffectively of late, to exercise a monopoly over in terms of its sale to bosses. And mainstream economics is based on a myth of economies naturally gravitating to a state of full employment equilibrium. They have a mythology of a night watch person state, that the state can just stand back from the market, ensure that basic fundamental rules underpin a market, particularly rules that have to do with private property, comically enough, and that then the market will take care of everything. The problem is that most governments, even governments that say that they subscribe to this kind of economics, have difficulty in working out what the fucking rules should be. And they keep changing their minds. And then there's the fundamental incoherence of mainstream neoclassical economics, whose theoretical framework was lifted, as Mirovsky, a historian of economics, has pointed out, it was lifted from 19th century thermodynamics. Holus bolus, and you've got an apparatus of equations, and you take it over from the study of heat and energy, and you apply it to an economy. 19th century thermodynamics has, in the realm of physics, been thoroughly superseded, but in the realm of economic theology, it still reigns supreme. To some extent, mainstream economics departments and governments also admit to slightly unorthodox perspectives on how the world works, and particularly Keynesian ideas deriving from the work of John Maynard Keynes, a committed defender of capitalism. And this argues in an under-consumptionist way, that is, the argument that people do not have enough purchasing power to buy all of the output that is created in the economy. It argues that crises are preventable, so long as governments adopt sensible policies to boost effective demand, which means not what people need, but what people have money to buy. And that can be achieved by easing monetary policy, either by reducing interest rates or by printing more money or increasing the money supply in other ways. Or, particularly if that doesn't work, through fiscal policy, which means taxing and spending policy. If the economy's turning down, you've got interest rates at zero, or, as has been the case recently, less than zero on official interest rates, and that's not doing the trick, well, maybe the government should step in and start spending big on major construction projects, or maybe for a brief period, as during the global financial crisis in Australia, some benefits for the poor should be increased. Along similar lines, there has been a trade union under-consumptionist argument that has been around since really the late 19th century, systematised by a guy called John Hobson, who wrote a very famous and influential book called Imperialism, which Lenin drew on in the imperialism side of it, not the endless consumptionist side of it particularly, when he wrote his little book on imperialism. And this argues that wages should be increased because this will be good for the economy. Now, we can agree, I think, with the first half of the sentence. Wages should be increased. But the second half of the sentence is a problem. Increased wages might be good for some capitalists, for some parts of the economy that are producing wage goods, that are producing the stuff that workers consume, but overall what they do is reduce the level of profit because they decrease the rate of surplus value. What the bosses get compared to what workers get out of what workers create in the economy. So beyond the very, very short term, increased wages are bad for the economy because it is a capitalist economy. We support increased wages nevertheless because they are good for the working class. Now, these kinds of approaches, under consumptionist approaches, are advocated by sections of the left, which argue that if wages were increased, if government activity were increased, even if certain industries were nationalised, especially banking, or at least if there were more controls, then things could be improved in the economy. And everybody except maybe the bankers who were expropriated, although I don't know that even Jeremy Corbyn calls for nationalisation without compensation, but even if he does, that overall it would be good for the economy and for those remaining capitals. This is an argument, in effect, for class collaboration. It's an argument that there is a common interest between workers and at least a significant section of bosses, and it's an argument for reformism. That somehow socialism can be reformism in the classical sense and social democracy in the classical sense here. That is, actually looking towards a socialist society rather than a Sweden multiplied across the planet where you still have capital. That socialism can be achieved very gradually without the need for revolution because socialist policies of an under-consumptionist, increased state regulation kind are good for the economy. But I think Marx was right that economic crises are inherent in capitalism, and the kinds of policies that are advocated by both right-wingers who say, well, like this government say, we are in favour of real wages. The Reserve Bank has expressed concern that wages are so low. And Friedenberg, the new treasurer, has said that he's in favour of increased wages. And the way to achieve them is by having more austerity and by increasing profit. And then there will be a piss-down effect on the working class who will benefit eventually from increased wages. And if that's right, or if the Keynesian approach, which the first bit of which we can agree with, or some of which we can agree with, that we're in favour of real wages, if that's true, then I think the argument for a socialist society becomes weaker. You can still make an argument, but it becomes much weaker. If capitalism is capable of consistently delivering the material goods for workers, then one of the main arguments for socialism, the argument that Marx made in the Communist Manifesto that I read out at the beginning, is dramatically undermined. Now, you might still make a case for socialism in terms of the alienating effects of capitalism, people's lack of control over their lives, which Marx, of course, also talked about and was actually a stepping off point in his manuscripts of 1844 for his development of a radical political economy, his development of his own labour theory of value, which only reaches fruition at the end of the 1850s when he works out where surplus value and therefore profit actually comes from, when he works out that vital distinction between labour power and labour. Labour power, the commodity, our ability to work. Labour, the actual activity that we perform under the control of a boss, which the amount of labour that can be extracted from the labour power that's purchased can vary depending on the degree of pressure that's placed on workers. There is some concession, though, to the idea that crises are inherent in capitalism. And what I want to do is give you a couple of brief quotes from two well-known proponents of proletarian revolution, both of them former chair things of the Federal Reserve, which is the central bank of the United States, which, let's be frank, does not have a reputation of sympathy for revolutionary Leninist Marxist politics. So Ben Bernanke, former, I think he was actually, he was the chair thing at that stage, in 2012 argued that we should not imagine, though, that it is possible to prevent all crises. And one of his predecessors, Alan Greenspan, had written that we are dealing with global forces beyond the control of domestic monetary policy makers, that is, him. The growth path of highly competitive markets is cyclical. And what cyclical means is that workers are going to cop it in the neck periodically under capitalism. Why is that the case? Well, I would argue, along with Marx and also with this guy, Henrik Grossman, who I've spent a lot of effort in writing about and in editing, that there are a couple of reasons for this. The first is grounded in something that's very, very basic to capitalism, that I think is relatively easy to understand, not too complex, and that is the way in which what we need to live under capitalism has two aspects. It has a practical aspect associated with the physical characteristics of the things that we need. The physical characteristics of water bottles, of the small amount of sugar that I have put in my water to make it a bit more palatable, of chairs and tables, of housing, of clothing, those sorts of things we need because of their physical characteristics. But under capitalism, these things with distinctive physical characteristics, or to use Marxist jargon, use values, also have another characteristic. We have to, you may have noticed, we have to pay for them. That is, they have a value as well. And Marx's labour theory of value, the law of value, is that what we have to pay is related in a fundamental way to the amount of labour that has gone into producing those commodities. The way in which that relationship occurs is not always direct, but underpinning what we pay for commodities is their value, and what determines the value of a commodity is the amount of labour that has gone into producing it. What Grossman, following Marx, argued is that radical disproportions can arise in economies, that is, tendencies not to equilibrium, the way in which mainstream economists argue capitalism operates, but tendencies to disequilibrium can arise because of different rates of growth in different sectors of the economy and the differences between the expansion of use value production
within a sector and the expansion of value production in that very same sector. So disproportion between sectors is fairly easy to understand. If the car industry becomes more productive, its output increases, but the tyre-producing industry becomes yet more productive, its rate of growth and expansion of productivity increases at a faster rate, then we're going to have problems of disproportion. In order for the tyre industry to prosper, its output has to be in proportion to the car industry, both in terms of the new cars produced with tyres and also the rate at which tyres wear out. But if productivity in the tyre industry has gone up more rapidly than in the overall car industry, there's going to be a glut of tyres. And this is related to a disproportion between the use value characteristics of tyres and the value characteristics of tyres. In order for the tyre industry to prosper, all of its output, or a large proportion, have to be purchased. Otherwise, there are going to be problems. But if the price of tyres has gone down, but their output has gone up due to the increased productivity of human labour, there are going to be problems if there hasn't been a similar proportional increase in the car industry as well. In the second volume of Capital, Marx dropped his preliminary assumption of equal production times, the production time being made up the periods required for the production of commodities, and also introduced the complication of circulation time, the period that commodities spend in the sphere of circulation after they've been made, before they're sold. Together, production time and circulation time constitute turnover time. Differences in turnover time are conditioned by the technical characteristics of the production process. How much you can put out in a given period of time, whether it's tyres or cars or any other commodity, depends on the nature of the means of production that you're using. And if you're using more machinery and equipment, you are likely, with a higher value in itself, you are likely to be able to produce more in a given period of time. But Marx, and Grossman emphasised this, the first person to do so after Marx, argued what this means is that even in simple production, that is where there's no expansion of the economy, there can be economic crises because there is not a replacement of some of the means of production on a continuous basis. What's called fixed capital, the big machines and the buildings and so on, are not replaced gradually. You know, one brick doesn't wear out and we just, you know, pull it out of the wall and then put another brick in. The building has to be replaced as a whole. And similarly, if we're talking about complicated machines or computers, you do not replace them little bit by little bit. You have to replace them all at once. And that means in the course of time, there will be periods in which fixed capital is not replaced or is replaced at a much lower rate, and periods of time when large amounts of fixed capital are replaced. But under simple production, when there's no growth, each year there should be the same amount of outlay, the same amount produced, the same amount invested in means of production as in every other year. But that, in the real world, cannot be the case. The duration of fixed capital, how long on average it takes to wear out and be replaced, is one of the things that governs the periodicity, the periods of time between economic cycles. And this is something that both Grossman, Marx, of course, and also a Russian called Pavel Maksakovsky in 1928 argued that crises are related to turnover time and particularly the turnover time of fixed capital. And that helps explain why there are recessions, not really deep great recessions or depressions, like the one that began in 2007-2008, but smaller fluctuations in the economy every 7 to 10 years. And it's been argued that some kinds of fixed capital, really basic infrastructure like railroads or port installations or really, really big investments like in steel furnaces and so on, their turnover time is much longer. And that can maybe explain longer cycles in capitalist development. I think that there's a case for that. Really long cycles or long waves, on the other hand, I have problems with. Basically a theory deriving from a non-Marxist Russian economist called Kondratiev. Okay. I think I've got time to take you through the course of an economic cycle. All right. Before we go through the economic cycle, I should talk about the other aspect of capitalism that leads to crises. And this is something that Grossman was the first person to really take seriously after Marx, but it is central to the argument of the third volume of Capital, if you ever get that far. I'm not saying that you have to. You can understand this theory. I think it's not too complex. Hopefully you'll have a kind of a grasp of it after I've finished rabbiting on. The argument that there is a tendency under capitalism for the rate of profit to fall. And the basis of this argument is fairly simple. It's that as capitalism develops, the productivity of human labour increases. If you think about how wheat was produced at the beginning of the 19th century and how much labour went into harvesting wheat... I'm using my sickle here. I don't have a hammer in the other hand. Anyway, harvesting wheat that way. And you think about how much human labour goes into harvesting wheat with them combine harvesters, which you may have seen out in a huge paddock, or like me, you've probably seen on the TV. These huge machines and how much human labour is involved in harvesting wheat that way. Even if we take into account the considerable amount of human labour that went into producing the machine, even when we do that, the productivity of human labour in agriculture, as essentially across the board, has dramatically increased. And why has it increased? Because there has been more investment of the boss's outlays into machinery and equipment compared with their investment in labour power. Their expenditure on wages over time. Is this complex? I don't think so. I think it's pretty easy to understand. And what's more, the tendency for the rate of profit to fall is easy to understand once, like all of us, we understand where profits come from. Profits only come from that part of bosses' outlays that go on wages. Because it is only human labour that can reproduce value and create new value. That is the labour theory of value, both Marx's and the previous labour theory of value of the classical political economists. And it's a very simple fraction. When I was teaching at universities for 26 years, the last few of which were pretty horrendous, people were afraid of fractions, especially art students. But it's a simple fraction to work out. If the profits depend on what is outlaid in wages, that's on the top line of the fraction, and we'll call it S for surplus value, compared with total outlays, and those total outlays are made up of what's spent on wages, we'll call that V, and what's outlaid on constant capital, the machinery, equipment, the buildings and so on, we'll call that C. So we've got S over C plus V. And C is growing at a faster rate than V, and we know that V is the source of the S on the top, the rate of profit will fall. And there is a long-term tendency for that to occur. Now, if it was simply that tendency, then, you know, capitalism becomes a global system sometime in the 19th century. Capitalism would have ground to a halt a long time ago. But Marx, in Volume 3 of Capital, talks about this fundamental tendency of capitalism, the tendency for the rate of profit to fall. But he says that there are also counter-tendencies that are built into capitalism that mean that the tendency is expressed in a halting way, in an on-off way. It's counteracted by these counter-tendencies at certain periods. And those counter-tendencies include screwing more labour out of the labour that workers, the labour power that workers sell to bosses. And that you may have noticed this, but if you've ever gone to work, people supervise you. What they're doing is trying to ensure that a significant amount of labour power is of labour is extracted from you, and preferably more. And there are other ways of doing that, by pushing down real wages so that the wages share of national income goes down and the profit share of national income goes up. And there's another mechanism that is intrinsic to capitalism, because this process of increasing the productivity of human labour means that the amount of labour that goes into our, well, Marx talked about bushels of wheat, but maybe we should talk about kilograms of wheat or kilotons of wheat. The amount of labour that goes into each unit of a commodity of wheat goes down. And ultimately that means that the prices of these things go down as well. They become cheaper because less labour has gone into them. This also applies to our combine harvester. The way in which combine... I'm no engineer, but I'm fairly confident that the way in which combine harvesters are produced has changed over the decades, and it's not a question of diligent workers carefully filing the parts of the machinery into shape, and that we have machine tools and computer-aided design and computer-aided production involved in making the combine harvester as well. So the C bit goes down as well in our fraction in the course of capitalist development because of the increase in the productivity of human labour. But there is competition under capitalism. A fundamental way in which bosses compete with each other is by trying to produce their goods more cheaply. And the way to do that is by screwing their workers more than their competitors, but also by stealing a march on their competitors in terms of the application of new machinery and equipment. And that pressure is always there. Even when competition is reduced, when there's monopolisation, the centralisation and the concentration of capital within individual countries, and the scale of enterprises increases and the number of competing enterprises goes down, they are still competing. And even if there's a monopoly in an individual country, there is competition on an international scale that pushes bosses to spend a significant amount of their profits on increasing the organic composition of capital, because in the short term they will gain benefits. They'll be able to be produced more cheaply than their rivals. They'll be able to sell more, and the price that they sell at will be a little bit below average for the economy as a whole or for the sector as a whole, but above their own costs of production because they're using this new clever new technology. But once everybody in the industry catches up or has gone out of business so that there are only people using the new technology in the industry, then the price of that commodity will fall to the average level again. So this process of competitive accumulation will continually bring us back to an increased organic composition of capital, even if there is a cheapening of the individual elements of the organic composition of capital. Right, now we'll go through... there are other counter-tendencies as well. You can find cheaper raw materials. You can find cheaper sources of labour power. And that's part of the explanation of China's takeoff of as a global power. Foreign investment in China. Now, there is self-sustaining Chinese investment in China, but part of the takeoff was foreign investment in China in order to take advantage of vast reservoirs of cheap labour there. Vast reservoirs which have been, to a significant extent, exhausted capitals from the developed world are now not looking towards production in China so much, and even Chinese capitalists are investing offshore. So there are a variety of counter-mechanisms. The course of the economic cycle, which I will get through very quickly, a recession is triggered by profit rates insufficient to stimulate new investment. That's stage one. This leads to a dramatic slowing down of the replacement of fixed capital in an effort to adjust production to demand. That is, if the economy's turned down, there's less demand for your goods, then you don't need to replace some of the worn-out fixed capital, machinery and equipment and so on, that you already have, let alone engage in investment to expand your overall production. The replacement of fixed capital is also further slowed by the purchase of bankrupt capitals by the surviving competitors. They buy the bankrupt machinery and equipment at devalued prices. Devaluation of fixed capital, however, helps restore profitability and expand output at lower prices again. The third aspect or moment or stage in the crisis cycle is that eventually the expiry of fixed capitals leads capacity to fall below demand and prices rise, prompting widespread renewal of fixed capital to sustain the existing capacity, the existing amount that can be produced. The timing of this point is related to the widespread renewal of fixed capital near the start of the previous cycle's recovery phase. So this is the way in which fixed capital, the characteristics of fixed capital, play a crucial role in the cycle. Expanded investment due to the replacement of fixed capital at a higher rate improves rates of profit and prompts investment to expand capacity as well. But as capacity expands, as there's new investment, especially in new technology, the organic composition of capital rises and there is a fall in the rate of profit, and eventually we're back at the beginning of the cycle. As Marx put it in the third volume of Capital, the true barrier to capitalist production is capital itself. Now, I was going to talk about rival Marxist theories for the tendency of the rate of profit to fall, but I have rabbited on for a long time already. What I want to say here is that this theory of the tendency of the rate of profit to fall identifies a fundamental contradiction in capitalism, in the very production process, in what is core to capitalism, the way in which it creates the use values that everybody needs, which are at the same time the values that the capitalists need to sell in order to make profits. It's right there in the production process and is governed by fundamental characteristics of capitalism in the nature of commodities and the fact that capitalism is a competitive system, competition which drives accumulation, competitive accumulation, and therefore the increased organic composition of capital and the tendency of rate of profit to fall. I want to say very briefly that there are a couple of places in the manifesto and also in Capital which can be interpreted in an under-consumptionist way, that the problem is that there is not enough purchasing power in the economy, rather than the problem being that profits are not being sustained at a high enough level and, in fact, are falling, and that this is what underpins economic crisis. But Marx explicitly rejected under-consumptionist arguments in pretty unambiguous terms in the third volume of Capital. He wrote, as edited by Engels, "It is pure tautology to say that crises are provoked by a lack of effective demand or effective consumption. If the attempt is made to give this tautology the semblance of greater profundity by the statement that the working class receives too small a proportion of its own product and that the evil would be remedied if it received a bigger share, that is, if its wages rose, we need only note that crises are always prepared by a period in which wages generally rise. The boom period is, except now, the boom period is generally characterised by rising wages." Sorry, I'll get back to Marx now. That was parenthetical. Where am I? "And the working class actually does receive a greater share in the part of the annual product destined for consumption. From the standpoint of the advocates of sound and simple common sense, such periods should rather avert the crisis." The point here is not so much the correct interpretation of Marx, but more fundamentally, which interpretation helps us understand the real world most effectively and what needs to happen in order to change the real world, in order to end the process where capitalism cannot support its slaves in their slavery. There's another approach to crisis theory, which is Grossman calls neo-harmonist or equilibrium Marxist theory, but I won't go into that. If you want to know more about it, we can talk about it in the discussion. If along with explicitly pro-capitalist theories, these theories, Marxist under-consumptionist ones especially, which have been very, very influential, especially in the United States, thanks to the work of a guy called Paul Sweezy, who wrote a couple of very influential books. If they're wrong, and if the mainstream theories are wrong, and capitalism is inherently crisis-prone, and the true barrier to capitalist production is capital itself, then Marx's solution to capitalist class's inability to assure an existence to its slaves within their slavery still applies. That is, workers' revolution, in which, to quote Volume 1 of Capital, the expropriators are expropriated.